Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. Today's guest is actor and advocate Michael J. Fox, whose new book is No Time Like the Future, An Optimist Considers Mortality. He's joined in conversation by novelist Harlan Coben. And now join Holly Furfer as she introduces Michael J. Fox and Harlan Coben.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. My name is Holly Furfer. So pleased to welcome you to a special evening featuring award-winning actor, Parkinson's advocate, and eternal optimist Michael J. Fox. And he's in conversation with international best-selling author Harlan Coben. I want to tell you first about Harlan Coben. He's got more than 70 million books in print in 43 languages worldwide. His books have been number one bestsellers in more than a dozen countries. He's also the creator and executive producer of many TV shows, including the Netflix original dramas, The Stranger, Safe, and The Five. He's currently, get this one, developing 14 projects for Netflix in the US and internationally. And the author of this evening is none other than the Michael J. Fox. He gained fame playing Alex P. Keaton on the sitcom Family Ties. His blockbuster movies include Back to the Future, The Secret of My Success, Doc Hollywood, Casualties of War, and The American President. He returned to television in his award-winning lead role in Spin City, followed by guest appearances in series like Rescue Me, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I'm going to say probably one of my favorites, The Good Wife. Absolutely brilliant. He has many awards, 5 Emmys, 4 Golden Globes, 1 Grammy, 2 Screen Actors Guild Awards, the People's Choice Award, GQ Man of the Year. In 2000, he launched the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research, which now is the leading Parkinson's organization in the world. He is the author of 3 previous New York Times bestselling books, Lucky Man, Always Looking Up, and A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Future. And he lives with his beautiful family in New York City. So without further ado, Mr. Harlan Coben and the honored Mr. Michael J. Fox. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Holly. What's going on, Mike? How are you, buddy?
Good.
All right, we're going to get right to the book. So Mike's new book just came out on Tuesday, Michael J. Fox, No Time Like the Future, An Optimist Considers Mortality. So I'm going to get right into it because I know that people want to hear it and they don't want to hear from me. So I love how you open with a bang, but I'm not going to open with that particular bang. But as a thriller writer, I love that you open with a nice, big, gripping, juicy moment. But let's start. You know, your career sailing along, 1991, is that when you discovered you have Parkinson's?
Yeah, I was in Florida doing a movie with Doc Hollywood, with Woody Harrelson. And we were out one night and woke up the next morning and I had a twitch in my pinky finger. And then I noticed I saw some shoulder pain. And I thought it was just the product of the carousing with Woody. It's never a good idea when Woody is on the movie and your location in a college town. Crazy. But so I had this set of symptoms the next morning, and then I just kind of watched them and observed them, and they increased. It began to involve my whole arm, it began to involve my shoulder in a much more constricting way. And I ended up in front of a neurologist at my wife's insistence. And I was 29 years old, he said, "You have young onset Parkinson's, but the good news is you'll be able to work for another 10 years. And that was a lot to digest.
Yeah. So you were 29. You're 59 now. Mm. I'm not a math major. That's 30 years ago. It's more than half your life.
The average age of someone diagnosed with Parkinson's is 58. So I beat it by a year.
And you know, you've written 2 other books, which are, you know, both great. I do favor this one. We'll talk about why in a moment. I think this is your best book, which is great. You're getting better at it, which is, you know, what you want to accomplish. But let's skip ahead. You know, you've had the challenges of Parkinson's. Everybody's sort of familiar with that. And now, a few years ago, you have another pain, another medical issue. You have a tumor on your spine, basically, right? I mean, that's where we go to next.
It's very difficult with Parkinson's. So many of the symptoms between Parkinson's and what I eventually discovered to be the spinal tumor conflate. They mimic each other, and so it's hard to parse one from the other. But I was distinctly having a lot of numbness in my legs and a lot of falling that was different than my Parkinsonian falling. It was more just kind of dead drop out of nowhere because my legs would give out. And then I had a kind of weakness in my soreness in my back and kind of a feeling of burning, which I suppose was numb. And so it was weird. And so it ended up being the spinal tumor that was not malignant, it was benign, but it was encroaching on my spinal cord and constricting to the point where I was nearing paralysis. So I knew I had to get it operated on, but not many people wanted to touch it. But I met this great doctor in Johns Hopkins named Dr. Theodore, who agreed to do it. He said, and I said, "What do you think other doctors didn't want to do it?" And he said, "You want to be responsible for paralyzing Michael J. Fox?" That's a good answer. But I hired him, and he did an amazing job. But the upshot was, it was in addition to 30-year-old Parkinson diagnosis, I had to learn to walk again. Once I did the spinal surgery, I had to that's not just kind of generally speaking. I mean, I had to literally learn how to put one foot in front of the other and land on the heel and transfer to the middle foot and transfer the weight from the other hip, and it was quite laborious.
No, I mean, I actually remember when we were traveling on a golf trip, and you know, there'd be times you would be, clumsier or awkward, but you would just, there's one time you just dropped in a sand trap like a stone. You just went down. And that's when you started to realize you had to, you had to take the surgery.
You hit your best wedge and you couldn't get me out of the sand trap.
I tried my best. Try pulling you out. Okay, so you go to Hopkins. By the way, I love that line that the doctor said that, do you want to be responsible for paralyzing Michael J. Fox? We were playing poker at Michael J. Fox Foundation tournament, and I remember I was sitting between you and Richard Kind, the actor who starred with you in Spin City, and you and I were kind of going against each other, and I had a chance to put in a lot of chips, and Richard goes to me, "Do you want to be the person who takes out Michael J. Fox at his own event?" And I still bet against you, but you had better cards, so you were just playing me anyway. So,
on one hand, I hate it, and the other hand, I love it. You guys are poker game.
Yeah, so let's get to you go through surgery, and you wake up and you have some really strange experiences, right? I mean,
I had my Parkinson's medication, which is quite extensive. It's a long list of pills I take in the course of a day. I had to take it because I couldn't become symptomatic on the table. So it was important that I be anesthetized and out and gone and completely still, because any minor movement would possibly damage the spinal cord, and that would be it from here down. So I was heavily medicated, and then they added to that the pain medication, the Dilaudid or whatever stuff, and I was just seeing bears coming out of the wall and gorillas and sea monsters. It was pretty intense.
It's terrifying.
I questioned the nurses and the doctors and said they were all conning me. I'm an actor. I know a con when I see one. And I said, I'm going to get my lawyer down here. My lawyer, Cliff, he's going to get you. He'll tell you. Cliff is like this entertainment lawyer in Los Angeles. Does contracts and profit participation. He would not know part of that. But it was a spooky scene while it happened. It overlapsed over a couple of days. And just the worst part of it was my daughter was there, Skylar, who comes up at it for the points in the story. She kind of fell in the muck on this one.
Yeah.
So, but she was there to see that. She was a recent psychology graduate college, so she knew she was seeing some high-level psychosis. I'm only hoping it was temporary, which it was.
So then you come home. You have to go through all sorts of therapy. As you said, it's hard enough to walk or do things that you do having Parkinson's, and people. But now you have to completely relearn how to walk, training your brain how to walk. What was that? How was that like? Was that just?
You just made me think of something. The way you phrased that question, you just made me think of with Parkinson's. Like a lot of my efforts went into masking, especially when I was working, masking symptoms and hiding symptoms. And the thing with the spine is, I had no control over that. There's no way I could manipulate that. It was much more deeply based and deeply entrenched in. And so there was nothing I could do to ameliorate it. It just was what it was. It was full force.
And there's no correlation between the fact that you have Parkinson's.
Completely just lucky.
Yeah, just lucky. All right. So now I want to get to the beginning of the book because I know it's a fairly dramatic moment, but you're going through this therapy. You're paying attention to the doctor, but you're not, because part of you, you listen and you're a good patient, but you're also a guy. And if even people remember you from, you know, even the early days of Alex B. Keaton, your comedy is physical. You are a physical human being. You like to move, right? It's hard for you to not be active and doing things, right?
I always played sports growing up, and by the time I took up golf, I was really not there physically. So that's my excuse for how bad it. But I also, even in movies, I never danced. I can't dance. If you put on a song that most people, a Motown tune, I can't do anything to it. But absent music, I can do things that you can apply music to afterwards to say that's dance. But I was doing it to music. And so I always loved that. And I loved even things like, I wrote in the book about, for some reason it just came to me, being in a Brian De Palma Steadicam shot. Brian De Palma is famous for, in his films, he has usually one or two shots that last for about 5 minutes. He follows the guy out of the building, down the street, into the car, down to the bar, out of the car, into the bar. And we did one like that in a Vietnam setting. And I was walking I played a private, and another recruit was walking with me. We were both talking about how to get your ass blown up in Vietnam and having this whole long conversation. And meanwhile, in the background, a village is burning. Helicopters are coming in. Smoke is streaming across. People are running out and getting shot. It's this whole elaborate thing. And if I blew one line, then they had to go back and reset that whole thing over again. And that was pressure. And the way I got through it was just get involved in the movement of it. Just the dance of it. And like I said, not to music, but to an eternal beat of this rhythm of words and rhythm of movement, matching the words to the movement.
And actually, you sort of have that with the Parkinson's too, don't you? I mean, there's times when it looks like you don't have control, but you actually pick up speed to get more control, and you have to stay out of your way then, right? I mean, it's like...
I'll tell you the Heisenberg theorem that you can't measure. You can't measure velocity and location at the same time. It's because by the time you pin something with location, it has any velocity, it's already moved. So, and that's the way I am. I can't picture where I am and how fast I'm going at the same time. I think about how fast I'm going, I deal with that, and I think, where the hell am I? I figure that out, and that's now that got me moving again. So I kind of say Parkinson's has weaponized me. Because if you see me coming down the sidewalk and I'm at all kind of lurching, just get to a safe place.
You have a great line in the book where you describe yourself, especially like you're worried around your mom because she's older, that you're like a pinball in a pinball machine, like just bouncing around and you're afraid you're going to set some lights off you're not supposed to.
I said in the book, I love my mother too much to give her a hug. I'm like a ball unleashed by the spring coil, and I just try to avoid the flippers.
That's a great line. It's, by the way, it is, you know, one of the things that I think will impress people. I know this because I know you. You wrote this book on your own. There's no ghostwriter. There's no, you have to dictate to people. You write the book on your own. It's so cleverly written. There's so many of those kind of lines that when I'm reading, I'm stopping and reading to my wife out loud, you know, the pinball being one of them. It's something that I think people will be surprised at, not just, you know, how funny and wise you are, we're kind of used to that, but just how well you turn a phrase. Is that natural, do you think? I mean, you know, you've always been quick, but that sort of way of turning a phrase, how where'd you get, is that something you've always had, sort of had, do you think?
Reading a lot of popular fiction and I read a lot of mysteries, so we became friends. and I just always loved the in terms of turn of a phrase and all that stuff, I just love words. I love puns. I love to take cliches and break them apart and make them mismatch them and just play around. I do a lot of that in the book. But I like the thing you alluded to, the bang that happens at the beginning of the book. Yep. It came from conversations I've had with you about story writing, a few conversations where you kind of say you want to load up, you want to start out with, get their attention. And also a book I read, I wish I remember the name of the writer. He was a famous, I think, Harvard writing teacher. And he talked about, like, he had done a magazine article where he went to Alaska. And he got there on a Monday, and on the Friday, he was attacked by a bear. And he said, but when his book started on Friday, not a Monday, started with the bear, lead with the bear.
Lead with the bear. So I want to go to this. We've been teasing this a little bit. But here you are, you have Parkinson's, you have serious spinal surgery, where really, if you jar yourself too much, and the doctors warned you repeatedly about this, it could be a huge setback, right?
The whole mantra was don't fall, don't fall, don't fall, don't fall. And from the moment I got out of surgery, the moment I came to out of my delusions, out of anesthesia, don't fall, don't fall. And at any time I ventured to take a step on my own, I'd be immediately arrested by a nurse who put me back in bed, and I just couldn't fall. Don't fall. So I'm thinking that all the way through my physical therapy, which lasted for a few months, and I finally get through physical therapy, and I'm walking fairly steadily. It's just kind of so-so. So now starting to understand the Parkinson's symptoms that's separate and apart from the spinal symptoms, trying to understand it all. We go on vacation. I have a series of aids that I have, and I finally get to the end of that line. They go, and I go on vacation with my family in Martha's Vineyard. And while I was there, I got a call from Netflix wanting me to do a cameo in a Spike Lee produced film by this guy named Stephen Bristol. It was a time travel movie. So I thought, yeah, I'll do that. And that'll be my kind of initiation, a reinitiation into independence and working and being on my own. So I said to Tracy, you stay in the vineyard. I'll just go over to New York, do this job, and I'll come right back. And she said, well, Skylar's coming home. She has my daughter, Skylar. Again, she was the one before, and we got home and we had dinner in my apartment, and she wanted to stay, and I knew that she wanted to make sure I got out in the morning without any incident. And I said, honey, I'm fine. Don't worry about it. You go home, go to your apartment, you got to go to work in the morning. I'll be fine. And I woke up the next morning, took 20 steps into the kitchen, hit the tile, fell down, and crushed my arm. And again, I had, don't fall, don't fall, don't fall. My family said to me, don't fall, don't fall, don't fall. So by my reasoning, at that point, lying on the floor waiting for the ambulance to come, which I called Nina, my assistant, and she'd check on the ambulance, I was just berating myself for what an idiot I was and how careless I was with people's concern. And then as time went on, and underneath the phone on the kitchen floor, and beyond then, my thoughts expanded to, I had me kind of pulling the wool over everybody's eyes with all this optimism talk. Because at this point, I was miserable. I only felt pain and regret. There was no shiny face to put on it. I mean, if I'd been taking lemons and doing something else with them, I was out of the lemonade business now for good. I just couldn't understand how I could be so foolish, not only to fall, but then to realize that I couldn't no longer cash that chip I always cashed of just put a chin up, carry on. And I couldn't. And I understood that my misery at that moment still wouldn't reach a one on the scale of some people's experience. But, and so that made it even worse, because we all get our own agony, and this was mine at the time. And things transpired from there.
This is why you fall, you're lying on the floor, you end up having a huge spiral fracture in your arm.
But all the while, not knowing if I did something to my spine, too. I knew my arm was damaged. I very well could have damaged. I assumed I damaged my spine.
Right. And you're just lying on the floor. Basically, you're there for quite some time. You're calling Nina. And I think, one of the things I think is interesting that you talk about is this is the first one you blame yourself a little bit, as opposed to you can't help the fact that you got Parkinson's or a spinal tumor. But this really, you can hear it. You can still, people can hear it in the timbre of your voice. And when we read the book, you're angry at yourself about this.
I was ripping myself a new one. I was really, I was so angry I felt the guilt that you referred to earlier, that all these people had put so much time and energy. And during my my rehab, you know, my children variously were there at different times, cheering me on. Tracy was there a lot, like cheering me on and supporting me. And we had a birthday dinner and she gave a toast about how hard I'd worked. And I just thought that I'd let them all down. My first thought went to, how it hurts. And I hope it didn't hurt my back. And what an ass you are for what you did to your family, what you did to these doctors who put so much time and attention into you, care into you, and gave you special treatment beyond what other people get it. Whether I want to admit that or not, that's true. And then I spit in the face of it by just being careless and being cocky. There's a, what's it called? It's kind of my proverb. The proverb about pride growth before the fall actually goes, pride growth before destruction. A haughty air goes before a fall. Mm. And I thought that was so appropriate. It was a haughty air, because that's what I had. I had a haughty air, and it went before the fall.
Wow.
You're listening to actor and advocate Michael J. Fox, whose new book is No Time Like the Future, An Optimist Considers Mortality. He's joined in conversation by novelist Harlan Coben on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So for those who don't know, just so you know, Michael has four children. Sam, two twin girls, and then the youngest. And Sam is now 30, and
the twins are 26.
Mm-hmm. And then you have the baby who's going to be a freshman next year in college, or this year, I guess. So she's now a freshman in college.
The gap year. She looks very women's school.
This is Skylar. And I know you have the arm break and
the other great few. Two great, terrible feeling that I had on the floor was Skylar. Skylar had been there the night before and begged to have me let her stay there and get me breakfast in the morning. And it would have, and by her way of thinking, I knew, would have been if she had been there, it wouldn't have happened. No matter how much I tried to reason with her later and say, I could have easily fallen in the bathroom and hit my head on the counter. So, but I knew that she felt bad, and I thought that was further fuel for my fire, my self-immolation.
This is kind of what I love about the book. That, you know, you're an optimist, and your books have been about optimism, but here your optimism is really being tested.
This is a cranky book.
it's not cranky, but I like it better because of those sort of grays where I think I saw you actually call it, which I don't agree with. You know, the optimism can kind of sound a little bit glib. You know,
yeah.
Here you are faced with something else.
Well, that's what I was worried about. I was worried about that no matter how well thought out my saying that I had reached an understanding with the disease, and I understood, I knew what space it took up, and I knew what space I had the room to move and thrive in outside of it. That all seemed really glib at this point. It seemed like, did I really mean that? And had I in some way, not with any kind of foul design, but just by nature of my personality, had I commodified hope, you know, had I put up optimism as a panacea, and then I really had a lot of guilt about that. It's like a guilty conscience.
So how do we start getting through that? How do we, you know, I remember when I was visiting you and you were going crazy because you would be sleeping at night and there was a nurse, like, literally watching you while you slept, right? Like you couldn't even do that, right?
One night nurse who had it was a guy and he had a hood and a beard. He was a biker. He parked his Harley up front of our building on Fifth, and I'd wake up and he'd have his iPhone up against his hood, and so it was reflecting off his glasses, glowing, and hood on, and he was kind of lurching, staring at me at the foot of my bed, and I just freaked out. Frank. So I got used to the kind of stuff, and people, I found that the day people that I had that would take me to rehab every day were really invested in my healing and really excited about my progress. And not that the night people were any less nice or kind, but their Their brief was completely different. Their brief was make sure I don't fall on the way to the bathroom. Make sure I don't walk. I don't fall. I don't fall. Don't fall. Don't fall. Don't fall. And it gets oppressive after a while. So it makes you find a hot air that will flew you down the hallway to your eventual demise.
So Holly said the book is about optimism, and it is, but it's a darker optimism, I think, for sure. How do we get there? I mean, how do we move? How do we get back to gratitude and optimism from where you are?
And they put in a pin and a plate and 19 pins. So I had this x-ray that the doctor gave me of my arm repaired with spikes and bolts coming out of it and a big plate in it. And then she showed me pictures of the fissure of the torqued crack in the arm. And I kept this x-ray in my phone and would show it to people when I was in the hospital a couple of days after. Because I realized with Parkinson's, I didn't have any x-ray like that. I never had a chance to go, this is what happened. This happened, and this went like this, and this broke, and they put in this bin. With Parkinson's, I didn't have that. So that made me think, I just started thinking more, because I had the time to, I wasn't doing anything. I just got more philosophical about it, and I just started to think about, what are the things I'm doing in my life, and what? And why do I feel differently about this in an instant? What grease the skids for that? And I just started to observe things, light things like what TV I was drawn to. I was also drawn to like old game show networks. They played like Let's Make a Deal from 1969. And I would watch, Western networks with Wanted Dead or Alive or Cheyenne or Paladin. Have Gun Will Travel. They're ridiculous shows and racist and politically incorrect and just awful, but I was fascinated by them. And I started to think, well, this is about mortality. This is about watching people that did this before I was even born. And then as I realized, I thought more about TV and the nature of television. I thought, well, that's me. I mean, I'm going to be survived by my reruns. And so that kind of gave me, for some reason, it kind of took the immediate sting away and still left me with the drive to find out more, to understand more. And it wasn't just things that happened subsequent to that. It was going back and looking at things that happened years before. And things like my golf career, my brief golf career, and how much hope was involved in that. And how what I loved about it was, no matter how bad I was, I always got better. It was the only thing in my life left that I was still getting better at. And I talk about that and kind of losing that to an extent and mourning that and seeing that as another part of mortality. But what I really arrived at eventually was what my father-in-law would always espouse, which was the idea of it gets better, kiddo. When I go to him with any problem, usually with my feelings about Tracy and about how I felt that I was burdening her with this thing that she'd bargained for. It wasn't part of the deal. But yet she accepted it and lived with it so gracefully and with such great understanding in the years since. Stephen Pollan would always say, he'd go through here, whatever my problem was, and he'd say, don't worry, kiddo, it gets better. And I started to find myself coming to that as I was coming out of this fugue, which was, it gets better. How does it get better? It's better through family. It's better through commitment to work. It gets better through learning and understanding. It's better through empathy and having that empathy return. It gets better through gratitude. Gratitude, optimism is sustainable.
You mentioned, of course, for those who, I'm sure all of you know, that Mike is married to the actress Tracy Pollan, who he met on Family Ties. It didn't work out for those two characters in Family Ties, but as Mike jokes, it worked out pretty well in real life. And Tracy is an amazing family, the Pollan family, the entire family. Tracy's sisters, and Tracy wrote several cookbooks and a whole thing on flexitarian. Her brother is Michael Pollan, who many of you know is a major writer. And even before I met you, around the same time, her father, Stephen Pollan, wrote a book called Die Broke, which was an interesting financial theory that I really loved. And you talk about Stephen's...
Corky Pollan, Tracy's mother, wrote the best...
I apologize. When I put the pollen women, I meant Corky as well, of course, Tracy's mom. So Tracy's mom, two sisters, and Tracy have a series of cookbooks and books on flexitarian eating, mostly vegetarian stuff. It's a ridiculously ambitious and accomplished family in which...
It would have been a very intimidating family to marry into if they weren't also goddamn nice.
It's an amazing family structure that you have there. And you write beautifully about Tracy's father's, dying his last few months and your visits and the conversations.
I used to bring him novels. I'd come with a bag of usually eclairs or something and a novel. And he very quickly... After a couple of visits, I appreciated most when I read Harlan Coben novels. The last time I had lunch with him, I'd go and have lunch with him, and I brought him the novels and a novel. I think it was Home, maybe at that point. I don't know.
Yeah.
What it was, but he was really grateful, and he would sit there in the banquette in the kitchen, and he'd have this cat. He had this little Himalayan cat. This Corky still has it, and it would crawl down his arm. Sip out of his water, crawl back up his arm, rest up on his shoulder. And so the last time I had one of those lunches with him was we had the novel and we were talking about family. And I was, at one point I broke down, I had an eclair, he didn't want one. But then we went into the other room, we were watching TV, we were watching some news and we were bitching about Trump. And then the doorbell rang and I went back. It's a big apartment, I had to go run. And I wasn't walking very well. I had to go long ways across the diagonally across the living room and the dining room to get to the service elevator at the back. And I see this scruffy guy through the old eyepiece that had been there since 1958 and had not been cleaned. And so I let this guy in. He was from the hospice, and he had all this hospice equipment because Steve had decided to spend his last days at home. And so this guy's coming in. So awkward. He said, get come in, I guess. And he said, where does it go? And I started taking him to the master bedroom, and Steve came out and saw us and kind of got, I think he understood what it was. And we went in the other room and the guy started to say, here's how the fan works. Here's how this works. Here's how this works. And then we were looking at him dumbfounded. Both Steve and I have no idea what he's saying. He goes, you understand what I'm saying? So you get directions. He's giving me directions. And he gives it to me. And then he goes back to stuff and he turns and looks up and says, which one of you is the patient? The last time I heard Steve laugh. He laughed so hard.
Wow. That's some story. I want to change subjects a little bit. We talk a little bit about the Michael J. Fox Foundation. Your work with Parkinson's, which you started, how many years ago now did you start it?
The foundation's been in existence for 20 years.
And it's over now. We've crossed the $1 billion, $1 billion with a B, folks, $1 billion raised to help find treatments and cures for Parkinson's. That's just an amazing accomplishment, Mike.
We'll take as many treatments as we can get. We just need the one cure. Right. That's all we're looking for. It's amazing, but it's an accomplishment for so many people. I mean, I had an idea and I had a thought, and luckily I ran into people like Nell Fortenberry, who you know, and other people, and Debbie Brooks and our staff and people that took an idea that I had and just a simple concept based on some conversations with some scientists and some politicians that the science was ahead of the money. I started to look at Parkinson's research and I kept coming back to this idea that the science was ahead of the money, that there's a lot of stuff out there that we just had to corral and understand to propel us forward. I didn't realize how wide the base had to be. I mean, it wasn't going to be a straight shot up. It was going to be a base and building a pyramid and getting to that top of the pyramid. And that's been a long process. If you had told me 20 years ago we'd be here 20 years, I would have been a little disappointed because I would have hoped to have wrapped it up by then. But I've grown over the years and learned that science is very hard. And there's only a few people that know how to come to some of these answers, and some of them are involved in other things. And yeah, I find the right people and get them the right amount of money to support the research. And we've done that. We've come up with a lot of great initiatives. The greatest thing that I think we've done beyond recognizing that the science is ahead of the money was realizing that we didn't want to have an endowment. We just wanted money to come in and go straight out, so we got to have the research identified before we get the funding. The funding would just pass through us. de Ragusa. And it's been really amazing. We've also got the patient community involved because we realized early on that we couldn't be this kind of silo research organization, that we had to involve patients because no matter who you bring to me, you bring me the greatest neurologist in the world, the greatest Parkinson's expert in the world, and he doesn't know about Parkinson's as well as I do because I have it. I can't express it the same way again in chains of molecules and in mathematical algorithms, but I know what it feels like. And I realized as a foundation, we had to harness that feeling and that knowledge from the people who are experiencing it and their families and the people that attend to them on a daily basis. And that's really informed our work. I think we're going to get there pretty soon.
You mentioned that this was originally going to be a golf book before the spinal surgery, right? You and I talked about this a lot beforehand, but this is originally going to be a golf book, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's a vestigial golf chapter left in the book.
Right. Yeah, the chapter where you outdrive me and make fun of me, but we'll let people read that.
That substantial golf shot I took was the one that I drove you in that.
Yeah, but having played with you quite a bit, what is it about golf? I mean, you have Parkinson's, and we've played for years together, and we played a lot together, and we've traveled and played together. And up until even, I think when we were still in 2017 or 18, when we were in, maybe 17, we were in Tampa, I think you were still insisting on walking the courses. What was it about golf that was it just the idea that you could, here you are, golf's the most impossible game in the world. Everyone knows that. And here you are with Parkinson's trying to play this golf. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's not like if you had Parkinson's, it's like somebody said to me, you have a disease you didn't pick. It was picked for you. You have a choice. You have to have another disease, but this time you get to pick it. So I thought, well, I'll pick golf. It's as serious a malady as Parkinson's in some way. If you did a Venn diagram of Parkinson's at golf, you can't be beaten. Will enervate you and cause you pain. So there's a lot going on. I just loved, like I said, I loved golf from the point of view of I got better at it and improved at it. And I loved it, and I loved the camaraderie. I just hadn't, because of the nature of my career and then my career in dealing with Parkinson's, I had friends, but I didn't have that many really deep friendships, as many as I've developed since I started playing golf. I mean, yourself included, obviously. Just really good friends, I used to think that the conversation on a golf course is stereotypical because I always said there's plenty of time for golf when I'm dead. I mean, I wasn't ever planning on playing it, and I can imagine the conversations being all about, and they may be to a large extent with most people, but about business and about the Kiwanis Club and about what the girlfriend's doing at the hotel later, or just I didn't want any part of that, but what I found was great conversation with people about everything, about politics, about golf, about life. And some of those conversations around the golf course, some of my most valued memories and most insightful conversations.
Yeah, I don't want to start crying here, but I feel the same. So, but also, yeah, I think there's something terrific about, the focus and watching you focus. And what people probably don't know about you, you reveal it in the book when you read it closely, is you're also a competitive SOB. It's something in a good way. You want to win, you want to accomplish. And so you go through all the usual stuff that a golfer goes through. Besides having the Parkinson's, it almost becomes secondary because you're playing against yourself and you're focused so hard. And I've never seen anybody swing so hard at the ball when you can't stay still. I mean, it's an amazing thing to watch.
You've got to make up for location.
You're also muddy. I'm going to tell one quick story. We were in Tampa, and Mike and I ended up getting kicked off sort of a flight, and we were stuck staying one extra day in Tampa. We managed to find the place to play the next day, but everybody heard Michael J. Fox was going to be there, so we're on the first tee, the two of us, and there are tons of people who have just come out to watch Mike hit. And of course, I slice my ball into the trees or whatever else. And Mike goes up and stripes it straight down the middle, 230 in front of everybody. And I don't think he hit another good shot the rest of the dang round. But that was the one you hit.
Englishmen, too. They're soldiers. A couple of soldiers. I mean, yep. pick the right people to impress. They're like, Semper Fi, dude.
Hey, look, Fox really played this game. So, it is an interesting sort of bonding experience. And I miss the golf book, but I'm glad I have this one.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is actor and advocate Michael J. Fox, whose new book is No Time Like the Future, An Optimist Considers Mortality. He's joined in conversation by novelist Harlan Coben. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
You know, you took a trip to Africa that you talk about a little bit in this book. And one of the reasons is, if I don't mention Curtis Schenker's name, our mutual friend, he will kill me because he went with the Schenker family and the Stephanopoulos family. This is after your surgery and after everything. And I love there's one great line in this when we're talking about the animals attacking or whatever else. And Sam's always like, we don't have to be fast, Dad. We just got to be faster than you if a lion's after going after us. We just got to be faster than you. What was that? How hard was that trip? And I guess the overall question is, we both have kids around the same age and reaching that stage, and we both love our family vacations. But aren't they better now than they've ever been?
Much better. And they've always been good. But I talk about them when they were younger, too. But there's like, you can get core samples of your life at that time if you look at the vacation photographs. But this was really interesting because this was after the year I broke the arm. I had the surgery. We lost Stephen. It was just Dennis, herbalist. And my wife Tracy started talking about going to Africa. I said, are you insane? I can't make it to the corner bookstore. I'm like, I'm completely out of commission. And she said, no, you'll love Africa. Safari, you'll be in a jeepy thing the whole time. Great. And she was right. It was fantastic. We were in this jeep. We had two other families with us, the Stephanopoulos and George and his family and Allie and the kids and the Schenkers and their three grown up children and us. And at one point we had this tree leopard we were all looking at. And we had the vehicles lined up, but kind of like haphazard, like cops at a crime scene. And we're all looking at this leopard in the tree. After we found it, it's like kind of funny, a leopard in a Seurat painting, you know, because it was just doubling down on the dots. And I found this leopard, and I was looking at it, and it was eating this young antelope it had killed. And I was just realizing that this leopard could be out of this tree and have me by the neck in 3 seconds, but he wouldn't because we're in the vehicle. The vehicle doesn't represent something holding a lot of people. It represents a big kind of beast on its own. The leopard wants nothing to do with it. So it's a feeling of danger because you're really close to the leopard, but it's a feeling of safety. And then the next day, we went out in the afternoon, and it started to rain, and George and his family went back to the base camp. We hid out near a watering hole under the cover of the trees till the rain stopped, and then we started to make our way back, and we got stuck in the mud, and we couldn't get it out, and the guy's winch, the guy's winch wouldn't work. Winch wouldn't work, and I get us out. So I'm thinking, well, I suppose I should volunteer to stay here with the vehicle. With his gun, takes my family back to the camp and sends for another vehicle because he couldn't raise it on the radio. So I'm sitting there and thinking, well, what if they did? What if I was here by myself? I'm literally by the watering hole. I'm old, sick, and lame. He'd be a leopard up in that tree because I know it's just like the fig tree he was in yesterday. Might even be the same fig tree for all I know. And I thought, God, it's not the leopard you know that scares you. It's the one that you don't know that may not even be there that scares the shit out of you. And then later on, I get back to the camp. We get rescued by another truck. I get back to the camp, and then we have dinner, nice dinner, and then go back to our tents at night. And I realize that's the real horror because all the lights are out in the tent. And if I have to get to the bathroom, I have to make my way through all this Africanalia and horns and old antique tables and writing desks and all that stuff that looks really cute and charming in the daylight. It's just a death trap at night because you can touch it, but it won't give you any support. So it just was reference for me going through the dark, finding my way to the restroom, latrine, in the tent, knowing that I couldn't lean on any of the walls as I generally do because it was tent walls and they'd come down on me and Tracy and nearest hospital was, God knows, 100 miles away. So that's the true terror. The things you go bump in the night, the things you can never see, you never would see.
Years ago, you got a tattoo? All over the book, by the way, there's pictures of it in the book. So tell us the story. It's a sea turtle. Looks a little worse for wear, the sea turtle. I remember when you showed it to me. Tell people why. Why the sea turtle?
Well, in different versions of it, in different books and different storytelling and opportunities, but this is the abbreviated one I give you for this purpose. In 1999, New Year's Eve into 2000, which is a bit of a reference back to earlier in the book when I talk about the 17 into 18 New Year's Eve, which is when I realized I had to get back and figure out what the spinal thing was all about. So jumping back to 1999, I'm trying to decide whether to leave the show and go and start the foundation. And I'm having a hard time making this decision. And I go for the last swim of the year before New Year's Eve, and I'm swimming, and out of nowhere comes a sea turtle. And I start to follow him, and I notice he's got a big chunk taken out of his fin. He's got an awful scar on his beak. And he looks at me and has no reaction. He just lets me swim along with him. So I'm swimming along with him, and I realize this guy is just doing the next right thing. And he's been through it all, and he's seen it all. And he's not fazed by me or anything else. He's just going about his business. And so I watched that for a while, and I had the privilege of swimming with it for a while. And I got out and met Tracy on the beach and grabbed a towel and said, that's it, I'm finishing the show and I'm going to start the foundation. So I always kept it on my mind. And then when I got through that year of the Annus Horribilis, I realized that I wanted a symbol of resiliency where I could find it anytime I wanted to use it. And I put the sea turtle on the inside of my arm.
At the age of 57, right?
And I actually posted the tattoo online just after I got it. And the major reaction was, you're 58. I was 58. You're 58 and you got a tattoo? And you missed the bus?
what was Tracy's reaction?
She hated it.
She hated it. I love that.
The secrets of the book is that I gave some pages to Harlan about halfway through my process. And he looked at them and he said, it's great. I love it. More Tracy, more showbiz.
That's right. I did. I recommended more Tracy and more of the, you know, because that's what, one of the things we know you from. We didn't even touch on.
Really, really, really talked
about a lot that back for the our kids and the kids our age and younger. Back to the Future is their Wizard of Oz. It's everyone knows you from that. Now it's still a movie people watch every year. What's that like? I mean,
when I was a kid and when you were a kid. There were like three television stations. It wasn't like a lot. And so there was no communicate. There was no downloading anything. So you saw like a movie like Wizard of Oz. Every year the same station would play it at the same time. Whether it was Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever. Right. I watch it every year. I wanted to see those flying monkeys. And the flying monkeys were everything to me. And I could still feel that way about Doc. Feel that way about the DeLorean. Feel that way about Marty and Johnny B. Goode. It's a real privilege to be associated with that.
I mean, you never try to run from that. You love that, right? I mean, you just love that cast. You love everything about.
I love it forever.
You get how rare it is.
Yeah, it's magical. I mean, to have had family ties and Spin City and to a lesser degree and Back to the Future, it's just amazing to have lightning strike three times.
It's an amazing career. So, what's sum it up for us? What advice, people that are listening out there? I mean, I know you hope always being the wise man sitting on the top of the mountain, but give us a little bit, you know, a few words of advice that you want to leave these people with as we go to the questions and answers the questions that they've posed for you.
I want to reiterate like what you just said. Like what I write is not prescriptive. It's not. I don't have anything to say for anybody that they can't learn somewhere else. But I just have my experience and I share it. And What I found is ultimately what I found with this book was the last chapter in the book takes place at Madison Square Garden, and we're at this concert, this Vampire Weekend concert, and Tracy's there, two of my daughters are there, and Tracy was dancing the whole time, and I'm kind of hanging onto the rail and getting up and out of the chair, and I took a wheelchair to get in, which was a big point of contention in the past, but I accepted and used happily to get to my seat, and standing there, sitting there, standing there, alternatively watching Tracy dance. She danced the whole concert. I just realized I'm grateful for this. And if I can find gratitude in anything, I can find a tiny bit of gratitude. Like I said, it sustains my optimism. I can find something to be cheered about and something to look forward to and something to cut out of the pack of all the crap and just say, this is a diamond apart from this muddy patch. And it makes me think there might be more diamonds on the other side, that muddy patch, and I'll push through. And that's kind of what gets me going.
Well, we're grateful for you. I'm grateful for this book. Holly, do you want to pop in and ask a few questions from the audience now?
Okay, here's one. And there's a lot of questions sort of in this vein. How do you keep your mental health in check? Do you have any advice for people who are struggling to keep it together during their struggles in life, whatever it may be? And also, I guess you can add, in this time of COVID, when we're all under so much stress and strain in our normal lives, what do you do?
The two are really related. It's interesting that you made that segue. Because the first thing I was thinking as you were talking was what advice would I give? And it's just don't isolate. Just don't isolate. And then, of course, you bring up the pandemic. And that's what we're told to do. And it's weird. It's like during the first period of quarantine, like March, my family all got together in our house in Long Island, and we'd stayed in there for months, just us, and it was an amazing time. Jigsaw puzzles and conversations over dinner and all this bonding, and all the while realizing all too well that there are people out there suffering, and people looking through windows at family members they couldn't get to, and people dying alone, and those two things can coexist. So, but one isolation you want to avoid, and one you want to embrace, but it's important. I think it's important to stay in touch with somebody who cares, somebody you care about, and just maintain, like, just someone you can say, I feel like this today. I'm going to go around with a smile on my face, but I feel like today. No, I'll know. And you look at them across the room. You know, yeah, I still feel like they go, yeah, I know. I know you do. I want you to feel better. I mean, just to keep a connection with life and nurture it, it'll grow.
People are asking about Parkinson's research and where's the research going, and when do you think, how far are we from some really incredible therapies and cures?
Well, hopefully we're pretty close. Like I said, we're concentrating on, and I'm not a scientist, so I don't represent pure science. I'm just giving you the ballpark of the patient and what I know we're going for. We're trying to find a biomarker. We're trying to find a way to identify the disease before it's evident, before any symptoms have occurred, and before they progress. And we get in prophylactically and treat that, and therefore basically cure the disease. But I see it more as buying us time to find the ultimate cure, which is to pinpoint the cause. And to that end, we've done research. We've gathered so much data about who's likely to get it, what symptoms we all have in common. If you have any, there's a menu of symptoms like loss of smell, gastro problems, cognitive problems. If you present all of those, and enough people, we can winnow down the group to where we get to where it's with Ashkenazi Jews have a higher percentage of. So we can find the commonality in all that. We can zero in on cure, so we're working on those things. At the same time, we're developing therapies. We've got 17 established therapies that we've been involved in the development of, and we're working on others. We de-risk early target research for big companies, for big pharma companies. We'll say, you're worth $10 billion, but we'll put in $5 million to do this research, find out something you want to pursue. And a lot of times, if they don't pursue it, other companies will come in and buy it from them and develop the technology on their own. So we cover a lot of bases. And I think the other day I talked to a guy who said he had a nephew who was 29 when he was diagnosed, same as me. I said, when was that recently? And he said, yeah, it's last week. And I said, well, he's 29 years ahead of me. I hope to see a cure in my lifetime, but he's definitely going to see a cure in his lifetime. And that was a good feeling.
So let's switch gears. Somebody wanted to know, what was your favorite role?
It's just, Alex P. McFly. Those two roles were just, I said it was lightning striking twice in my life, and on a professional level. And it can't take one from the other. Martin McFly was great because he was so, I mean, both characters were just really transparent and of life and just in the experience and the adventure of life. And so at the age when I was playing both characters, I really identified with that.
And somebody had asked, what was the most difficult scene to film in Back to the Future?
The most difficult scene to film? I want to say, it was actually from an acting point of view, being the age I was and the experience I had, when dealing with a dead Doc, I thought Doc was dead. I just really struggled with that scene. We had a hard time, whereas with like the Johnny B. Goode scene, it was just like cake for me. That's, I've been doing that since I was 15 years old, playing the guitar and bouncing around. So that was a lot of fun. But to deal with, ironically, to deal with mortality as a 21, 22-year-old actor, you know, in a really serious way, in a big movie with lights on, I just choked. I had a hard time with it. Got through it.
A lot of people are asking, what's your daily mantra when you wake up every day? What gets you through the day?
Just noticing little improvements and things that are better. Like if I walk in the morning, walk down that same hallway and down to breakfast and I'm walking well and I'm moving at a good pace and I'm not favoring the left leg and I'm not buckling my knees and my progress is smooth. And that makes me happy and I'm good for the day. If I make my way down the hallway and it's difficult and I'm leaning on walls and I'm using a cane and I'm touching doorknobs as I go to make sure I'm okay, getting around and walk my way along the wall to the table, I think, well, it gets better from here. It can only get better from this.
And the last question I will ask you that a lot of people want to know is, what's next for Michael J. Fox?
I want to survive this book tour. I don't know. I may write something else. I plenty of ideas. In some fiction, I'll be bugging Harlan like crazy for notes. If I bug him this time, I'll bug him like crazy by writing.
Stay off my lawn, Fox. Stay the hell off my lawn.
Your kids get off my lawn. I don't know. I just kind of alluded in the book to some experiences I had at the end of my second acting career. And maybe think I might not want to carry on with that. But there's always a possibility that someone could bring me something I can't resist doing. So I'm open for anything. I mean, there's something next, and I'm here for it.
Thank you so much, both of you gentlemen. What an amazing, inspiring, fascinating conversation. We appreciate you both. Harlan, best wishes to you. Michael, best wishes to you. We hope to see you all soon. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thanks, Holly. See you later, Mike.
You inspire me. Thank you. Thank you, Harlan.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was actor and advocate Michael J. Fox, whose new book is No Time Like the Future, An Optimist Considers Mortality. He was joined in conversation by novelist Harlan Coben. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pemenswan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.